So my name's Brian Matthew. I'm a program manager in the storage, file, and data protection team. Our team is responsible for delivering storage, the underlying storage platform, so disk drivers, store ports, the whole storage stack, storage spaces, file systems such as NTFS and REFS, and consumer file systems that you're familiar with, such as FAT32, EXFAT, et cetera. And also data protection mechanisms like snapshotting, backup, and file history, which some of you may have heard of. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about tiered storage and some best practices for tiered storage. We're going to first give an overview of a couple of customer deployments. I just want to highlight these deployments because there's some really interesting things these guys are doing. I want to give a brief overview of the software-defined storage stack. Now, I know I'm sure you guys are familiar with spaces at a high level, but just to level set with those in the room that may not be as familiar, a brief overview shouldn't take a lot of time. Then we're going to get into deployment planning, looking at what you should think of when planning a new storage deployment, and of course, sizing recommendations for performance, resiliency, and capacity. Once we've illustrated how to plan this deployment, we're going to go through step-by-step deployment validation guidance to make sure that the hardware you're using works and works properly, and the software configuration that you put on top of this hardware is A-OK. Then we're going to talk a little bit about how, once you have your storage, your cluster, your workloads up and running, how you can monitor your workload performance and health, and then troubleshoot any issues that arise, either be it health or especially for performance, because tends to be performance troubleshooting is rather difficult. So we're going to walk through each step of the stack and figure out how you can best troubleshoot deployments with storage spaces. But before I get started, actually, I just want a show of hands. How many of you guys have heard of spaces before this talk here today? All right, that's a really good number. So how many of you guys are using spaces in like a test lab, at least a test lab? How many of you guys are using spaces in deployment? All right, good a number of hands. And how many of you guys are using tiered spaces? Wow, just the same amount. You know, that's really great to hear. So I've been presenting on spaces for the past 2 years. Starting with TechEd 2012, TechEd 2013. Obviously, the number of hands at those years were much lower, but it's great to see the momentum move forward, especially with all the hardware vendors we have on board that support and provide spaces-compatible hardware and even full end-to-end software-defined data center solutions. So it's really, really great to see all this momentum, and I hope that you folks will get some good information from this session. And if you're interested at the end, please definitely come to the front and we can have an extended Q&A session, or I'll be available at the booth. My colleague, Chris Robinson, will also be available at the front for questions. But because the room is so large, I would like to ask you to hold the questions until the end. You know, jot them down and I can ask them out of the front of the room when we're done the presentation. So let's jump right in. As I said, we shipped the software-defined end-to-end stack. So that which defines the software-defined data center in server 2012. Storage, networking, compute. We shipped this in 2012. Okay? Now, since then, between TechEd 2012 and TechEd 2013, there was less than a year, but we managed to make great improvements to each layer of the stack. Just in storage, in even just in our team, with R2, we enhanced spaces with tiering, automated data tiering, dual parity, parity in a cluster, parallel rebuild, write-back cache. All these features that you would expect from a traditional storage array, we provide these in-box with Windows, with your Windows license. We did a lot of work in this release, and our momentum moving forward is even more. Let's talk about a couple of case studies before we jump into the meat of the matter. A specific hoster has been using Spaces since 2012. Actually, technically, he's been using it since beta versions of 2012 are out there. He needed a storage platform which provided dramatically reduced capital expenditure of first acquiring the hardware, and then once he has the hardware in his lab, he needs something easy to manage that is able to reduce his operational expenditure through the life of that hardware. And by using Spaces, he reduced his capital expenditure of over 30% of traditional storage. 30% over traditional storage. And he got similar capabilities. But he got another capability that he really loved, and that was scalable, just-in-time online expansion of capacity and of that deployment. So he's not going to make, or as he puts it, he's not going to make, quote-unquote, big, lumpy capital expenditures. He's not going to make those big investments up front, because he only has a certain number of users at any point in time, and he only has a certain amount of user incoming rate as well. So he's going to buy his storage, he's going to buy his compute in much smaller scale units only as he has new customers come online. And with Spaces, he can bring that online very quickly. So he's also able, because he can bring things online so quickly, he's able to deliver new capabilities to his customers very, very quickly. And he's also just started to deploy tiering. And while tiering provides him automated data movement based on heat, he's able to further differentiate his tenants based on service levels by using our pinning APIs. So he can pin specific tenants to specific tiers if they need to be faster or they don't need to be as fast, if they just need bulk storage. Another hoster is an energy company that we've recently been working with. And this energy company has very large data storage requirements. So they need a ton of capacity. They also, coincidentally, have high I/O workload requirements to store and process very large seismic data. This data is in hundreds of gigabytes, and there's a lot of it. There's a lot of concurrent users, there's a lot of concurrent processing that goes on with this data, this geological data. All right, his deployment right now looks like 4 file servers, and 6 60-bay JBOD enclosures. Each of these enclosures has 12 SSDs and 48 hard drives. Now that's a ton of capacity, almost 900 terabytes of raw capacity in just 28U, and that's including those file servers. And he actually has a replica site with a similar configuration, and he uses Hyper-V Replica to replicate between them. So he has a ton of capacity, it's resilient to disk failure, it's resilient to enclosure failure, and it's resilient to an entire rack failure. Spaces, in early testing, gave him exceptional performance. So multiple gigabytes a second of throughput, of random throughput, driving both VMs and seismic data analysis, and incoming seismic data as well. He had quotes from other vendors, traditional storage vendors, but those quotes gave him 4.5 times greater dollars per terabyte for raw capacity than with Spaces, and gave him 2.5 times less capacity density for raw storage than with Spaces. So Spaces gave him performance, density, cost, and capacity. Before we talk about deployment guidance, I want to walk through a brief overview of the software-defined storage stack. Now, this is just one component of the software-defined data center, the storage component. But of course, I'm sure there's tons of other sessions that talk about software-defined networking and software-defined compute. A Spaces deployment starts at the very bottom, the physical disks. So these are raw disks that are inside JBOD enclosures. So here I have 24-bay 2U enclosures and for a total of 48 disks. All right. With Spaces, I'm not thinking of my deployment in terms of my physical disks. I create a storage pool that abstracts these disks and isolates them from other disks. And this storage pool is my point of management. You're probably familiar with storage pool from traditional storage today. It's a very similar concept. Now, from the storage pool, I can carve out storage spaces. Or these are just virtual disks, in other words. Now, these virtual disks, when I want a virtual disk, I ask Spaces, I ask my pool, I want this virtual disk with a certain capacity, with a certain resiliency, certain performance levels. And if I want tiering, I say which storage tiers I want. I say what capacity for each tier. And Spaces goes and finds how best to satisfy my requirements and returns to me a virtual disk that gives me the best performance for the requirements I asked. Now, this performance is achieved through a few methods. Some of them are tiering, write-back cache, but the main method is data striping. We utilize the throughput of all the disks in your pool simultaneously to deliver the best performance we can given the hardware you've given us. And Spaces has a capability such that if I have an enclosure failure, we're actually resilient to that because we store data copies on separate enclosures to survive that event. Now, disk failures are obviously inevitable. They happen. And we need to ensure that once a disk failure happens, we can first identify that a disk has failed, but also recover from that state as quickly as possible. Because when a disk fails, obviously performance goes down, and the risk of further failure dramatically increases. So Spaces can actually rebuild to multiple disks simultaneously in the event of a disk failure. So you can picture, the traditional picture looks like, if I have a hot spare, my rebuild throughput is limited to the throughput of that single hot spare. That's not the case with Spaces. With Spaces, I'm rebuilding to multiple disks simultaneously, utilizing the throughput of all those disks. And it doesn't cost me anything. I use the same capacity reserved, set aside for parallel rebuild as I would if I had a hot spare. But with parallel rebuild, I'm not just letting that hot spare sit there idle, sit there spinning, consuming power, consuming heat. With Spaces, I'm using all my disks, just setting aside some capacity to give me parallel rebuild. And this is a unique feature that Storage Spaces gives you. New in R2 is the capability for a virtual disk to utilize the best characteristics of SSD and the best characteristics of hard drives, namely both performance and capacity, respectively, in a single virtual disk, in a single namespace, and Windows will automatically in the background measure the heat of your workload at a sub-file granularity, move your working set to the SSD tier, and move all other data to the HDD tier. And this gives you the best IOPS per dollar and dollars per terabyte you can get out of your storage. While this data movement, this heat calculation, occurs automatically, administrators can further override the automatic placement and pin files to a specific tier. So I talked about the hoster that uses this mechanism to differentiate service levels between his tenants, and he finds this capability great. Also new in R2 is the capability of a virtual disk to have a per virtual disk write cache that uses SSD capacity to absorb write bursts, so bursty write activity, to my hard drives to help improve write latency and reduce any spikes I see in my write I/O pattern. So that was a Spaces in 5-minute nutshell capability overview. Now that we understand some of the high-level capabilities of Spaces, let's now build up the hardware configuration from the ground up just to show you at a hardware level what Spaces looks like. Of course, we're again starting from the disks. In this case, it's a 60-bay JBOD enclosure, so it holds 60 disks. I'd, of course, need Windows file servers, and in this case, I have file servers with dual SAS HBAs. Now, these are HBAs. These are not RAID controllers. These are HBAs. This SAS enclosure has two I/O modules at the back of it for redundancy, and this specific model has 4 ports per I/O module. So that means it has a total of 8 ports. So with 8 ports, I can connect in a redundant manner up to 4 servers, like so. You'll note that this connection is a SAS fabric. It's not Ethernet, it's not Fibre Channel, it's not iSCSI, it's SAS. But each SAS cable actually has 24 gigabits per second per cable. That's 4 lanes of 6 gigabit SAS traffic. Okay, and SAS actually just got upgraded to 12 gig recently. So you'll soon see 12 gig JBOD enclosures that'll double this throughput. And I can similarly, because I have enough ports, I have enough SAS ports on my HBAs on the file servers above, I can attach 3 more JBOD enclosures for an aggregate SaaS Fabric throughput of 768 gigabits per second. Now that's a staggering amount of throughput in that fabric. You're really not going to bottleneck that anytime soon. That's the hardware layer. Now this is what the software layer looks like. First thing I do is I'd cluster these Windows file servers. Okay? What that means is I'm going to need a high-speed Ethernet fabric between the file servers, so 10 gig, 40 gig, or such. And these file servers now participate in what we call a Windows failover cluster. I'm sure you guys, every person in the room, I'm sure has heard of that concept. I have all these physical disks down here, and I create storage pools to aggregate and isolate them in different scale units, depending on what my workload requirements and business requirements are. And then from each storage pool, I carve out resilient storage spaces. When I do this, I want to make sure that I create enough spaces, and I create enough spaces such that each file server node is load balanced with a number of spaces attached to them, such that when my workloads start talking to my storage spaces, the throughput is even across all the file server nodes. Even though I have multiple storage spaces and multiple file server nodes, I still have a single point of management through CSV. CSV presents a unified namespace. In this deployment, I create a scale-out file server role, and on each space, I create a share, which would be used for data access from my compute nodes. So everything below the little green arrows there is my storage box, my storage, just my storage, and the purple would be my compute. You'll notice that they're disaggregated. So I can scale my storage, I can scale my compute independent of one another, and they still just be accessed over SMB. With traditional storage, the picture diagram is actually quite similar, except that green SMB there is not SMB, it's either Fibre Channel or iSCSI. So you're changing the protocol, but your workload accesses the storage just the same, because your workload operates on files. So I've shown you high-level capabilities of spaces, shown you what the software and hardware deployments look like. Now let's plan the deployment. Now let's figure out what kind of hardware I actually need for this deployment. How do I choose hard drives? How do I choose SSDs? How many do I need, et cetera, and so forth? I'd want to first understand how many drive failures must my deployment be resilient against. Do I need to survive one drive failure, two drive failures? And then I need to understand how many enclosures do I need to be resilient against in the event of a failure. So do I need to survive an entire enclosure failure? Do I need a little more than that? That affects how you would scale your deployment, how you would choose servers, how you would choose disks, how you would distribute those disks between the JBODs. I need to understand how much capacity I need, because different resiliency schemes have different capacity requirements to maintain that resiliency. And of course, I need to know what my workload's intending to be. So for instance, if I was running an archival workload, I can use more efficient capacity schemes such as parity. If I was running virtualized cloud workloads, I would use mirroring, for instance. And that would affect capacity and resiliency. For capacity planning, you want to choose your resiliency according to your workload and your resiliency needs. So again, if you're using an archival workload, you can choose a dual parity resiliency scheme. Now, the capacity efficiency for dual parity, the first dual parity there, the enclosure-aware dual parity, is 57.1%. So that means is that if I have 100 terabytes of raw storage, if I create a dual parity virtual disk, it'll give me roughly 57.1 terabytes of storage. It'll use the rest to maintain resiliency. Okay? And dual parity, the first dual parity, requires 4 storage enclosures in order to be resilient to one enclosure failure plus an additional disk. If I was running virtualized workloads or just general purpose workloads, I'd want to use mirroring. Two-way mirroring provides resiliency to a single disk failure at a capacity efficiency of 50%. and requires a minimum of 3 enclosures to survive an entire enclosure failure. 3-way mirror is resilient to 2 drive failures, has a little less capacity efficiency, but can actually survive with only 3 enclosures, can survive an entire enclosure failure plus an additional disk. And 3-way mirroring gives you the best performance for your work virtualized workloads. So that customer I was talking about, that energy company, even with 3-way mirroring compared against traditional storage using RAID 6, Spaces was still half the cost for dollars per terabyte. It just goes to show you how dramatically, how Spaces, how the software-defined data center stack dramatically lowers your capital expenditure. In a clustered storage pool, we can scale to 80 disks in that pool and 4 pools per cluster. But this is okay because you can choose, because when you want to create an enclosure-aware deployment, you can choose disks from each enclosure to participate in that storage pool, and that enclosure can actually split the disks. So I can choose a third of the disk from one enclosure, a third from another, and a third from the other. And that'll give me enclosure awareness. We have this requirement here because that we found in the most degenerative case. So when I have, for instance, a pending metadata update to my storage pool, and let's say my node goes down, the node that owned that storage pool, he fails. When we fail over to another node, and this happens automatically and transparently, when we fail over, we need to bring that pool back online. But that actually involves checking if there was any in-flight operations while that pool, when we bring that pool online. And we found that we can scale nicely up to 80 disks, even in the most degenerative case. So that's why this requirement is in place there. In addition to planning capacity for the intended resiliency scheme, so for instance, 2-way mirror, have 100 terabytes, I get 50 terabytes, you need to also plan ahead additional capacity for a few things. I talked about parallel rebuild at the start of my presentation, and with parallel rebuild, you want to reserve at least 1 or 2 physical disks worth of capacity for each storage tier, depending on the resiliency you have. So this is no different than you setting aside an entire physical disk or 2 physical disks in the case of hot spares. I'm actually not using the same amount of capacity, but in the event of a hot spare, I'm not using the performance of those additional spindles. Okay? You want to do this for each storage tier, both HDD and SSD storage tiers. You want to also reserve capacity for each virtual disk, enough capacity for the write-back cache. Now, the write-back cache size is by default 1 gigabyte per virtual disk, given you have enough SSDs in your pool. But depending on your resiliency requirements, if you have resiliency to 1 or 2 disk failures, we're going to keep 2 or 3 copies of your data. That also means we need to keep 2 or 3 copies of the write-back cache. So that 1 gigabyte will actually consume 2 or 3 gigabytes of SSDs. And you want to also consider for tiered deployments to not just go ahead and split the SSD tier evenly among the virtual disks. You actually might want to consider reserving some SSD capacity, putting some SSD capacity in your back pocket, giving some initial capacity to each virtual disk, allow those workloads to accumulate heat, to get established, and then, I'll talk about how to do this later, looking at the tiering report, figure out which virtual disk actually should get some more SSD capacity to deliver better performance, to better hold the working set. Because, you know, not every virtual disk will see the same workloads. It just depends on what workloads you choose to put on that virtual disk. So this is a consideration that you should take a look at when creating your tier deployment. Now, one topic that a lot of people wanted additional information on is how to choose data copies and data columns, and what data columns means on performance. So here I have 8 physical disks, the same capacity, and I want to create a 2-column, 2-way mirrored space with these disks. What this means is that two data columns, when I have an I/O, let's say I do a write. I do a write to this physical, to this virtual disk. When I do a write, my I/O is split into two, is then striped across those two data columns. So I have one portion of my I/O that goes to one disk, a smaller portion of my I/O that goes to one disk, and the rest of the I/O goes to the other disk. This means that the aggregate performance of my I/O is actually the aggregate performance of those disks. Those disks had to do less work to service my I/O versus just using one disk. Okay? If one disk can only do 100 megs a second, and I had an 8K, and I had a 1 meg I/O with two column count, my speed of my I/O is actually 200 megabytes a second now, because both disks had to do less work, and they did it simultaneously. But because this is a mirrored space, I need to maintain multiple data copies. So I would similarly stripe across another two disks. If I had a three-way mirror, I'd stripe across another two disks. The performance of writes with spaces, there's an easy formula you can use. That's basically you take the performance of a single disk, you multiply it by the number of data columns, and that should be the ideal performance of a write with a mirrored space. Spaces can actually read from all columns and all data copies simultaneously. So the ideal performance of reads can actually be the performance of a single disk times the number of columns times the number of data copies. So if each disk can do 100 megs a second, your read would be 400 megs a second, ideally. And your write would be 200 megs a second. Okay? But spaces doesn't restrict your performance just to what the column count dictates. If you have parallelism among your workloads, so you have your workloads spread across your disks, and spaces will do this automatically, by the way. Your workload spread across the disk, it's all accessing the disk simultaneously, it's storing lots of parallel load. Spaces will give you that parallel performance. It can do multiple I/O requests simultaneously. Okay? Each disk can build up queues, and those queues can be satisfied by the disk, and be satisfied all in parallel. There's also another implication that column count and data copies have. In this case, I have a two-column, two-way mirrored space. If these physical disks were to fill up, completely fill up, but I wanted to extend my virtual disk with more capacity, I would need a minimum of number of columns times number of data copies, additional physical disks, because I need enough disks to be able to stripe against two of them and then mirror against another two. Or in the case of a three-way mirror, mirror against yet another two. So columns and data copies determine performance and determine the expandability of my storage space, the requirements to expand my storage space. And these are key concepts in planning a deployment for now and for the future. Okay. As I add more disks, as I have more disks in my storage pool, the performance of spaces using that parallelism I talked about in the previous slide, the performance of spaces scales alongside the performance of those disks. So what I measured here is I took 92 drives, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 92, and I compared the aggregate performance of doing I/O towards all those 92 drives simultaneously without spaces, just the drives with a file system on it, versus putting all those drives in a storage pool, creating a two-way mirror with up to 8 column count. So even though I restricted my column count to a maximum of 8, even though I could have done more, the performance of spaces, because of this parallelism, scaled with the disks. And it's important to understand, when you test your disks, when you do performance evaluation, it's important to test at a load which will give you latencies which your workloads can accept. Now, a 7200 RPM SAS drive can give you up to 210 IOPS, but the latency at that level of IOPS are going to be 80 to 90 milliseconds, and the max latencies are going to be much higher. So by dialing down the workload, dialing down the queue depth or the load on the physical disk, which brings the latency, let's say, down to 30 milliseconds, my hard drive can now only do 100 IOPS. So when you go and evaluate your disks, make sure you adjust the load accordingly. Don't just try to maximize the IOPS of the physical disk, because when you put that into production and you use that number for performance planning, you will not get good results, because your latencies will be much higher than you have expected. When you're creating a store, when you're planning for number of disks in your pool, what types of disks, when you're not using tiering, make sure you have enough SSDs in the storage pool for the write-back cache to match the number of data copies maintained by that virtual disk. So I talked about the write-back cache being 1 gig and requiring 2 or 3 gigs of capacity. That means the write-back cache is going to use 2 or 3 devices, depending on your resiliency. If I have a dual parity, I maintain 3 data copies, which means I need 3 SSDs for the write-back cache. If I have a two-way mirror, maintains 2 data copies, I need 2 SSDs. And these SSDs can share capacity among each other for all the write-back caches in the pool and even for storage tiers. So I'm not just dedicating SSDs for the write-back cache. It's all shared. For options like column count, interleave, and write-back cache, it's important to plan ahead to ensure you have a good number, but we recommend you start with the defaults for advanced settings like these. For column count, we've actually found that for most workloads, past a column count of 8, you do not see a lot of gains in performance. In fact, there are some interesting effects which can actually reduce your performance. I'm not going to get into it here, but do come up to the front if you want to learn more about that. This paper down below talks a little bit about interleave and column count, so be sure to check that out. And we'd appreciate any feedback you have on this paper. There's lots of comments at the bottom, but we'd appreciate any additional feedback you have. One often overlooked part of performance planning is ensuring that you have enough compute and throughput or bandwidth to drive the throughput and IOPS that Spaces will deliver. This is not only compute and bandwidth at the servers. This is actually bandwidth in your network architecture, bandwidth in the server for PCI lanes, for instance, and ensuring you have enough cabling bandwidth between your storage and your file servers. So for the SAS fabric, make sure you use MPIO to aggregate multiple SAS links together, not only for redundancy, but also for performance. And similarly, with Ethernet, you want to use SME multi-channel or NIC teaming, depending on your needs. And to figure out if you have any bottlenecks, especially for compute and bandwidth, you want to use synthetic benchmarks at each layer of your stack to ensure that you're driving the amount of IOPS and megabytes per second that you expect from your storage, that you expect once you did all the performance planning, figuring out how your deployment should have scaled for a certain block size I/O. Okay? To figure out if you have latency bottlenecks or bottlenecks in the IOPS, you want to ensure that you test your deployment with small random I/O. And to ensure that you have enough bandwidth to get high throughput, you want to test your deployment with large I/O. And you can use tools we have online, such as SQLIO. And I'll actually walk you through a demo how you can do that. Tiering. Tiering does introduce a couple of new variables when sizing. But most basically, you want to design for what's practical in the number of drive slots you have for your enclosures. Spaces doesn't constrain the number of SSDs or the SSD capacity you can use in your virtual disk. So my colleague, Tobias, on Monday showed a demo where we had an all SSD storage, we had a storage pool with 24 SSDs. He got 1.4 million IOPS across the cluster. And on a single node, he got close to 700,000 IOPS for a file pinned to the SSD tier. So each node can deliver a lot of IOPS, and we don't force you, we don't say, oh, you can only use 5 SSDs. You could use as many SSDs as you want. You can use all SSDs if you want. But it's important to invest in a sufficient number of SSDs for a couple of reasons. You want a sufficient column count for both the SSD and the HDD tier. The SSD and the HDD tier have the same resiliency setting and the same column count. But because you typically have less SSD devices, the number of SSD devices will be your determining factor when you choose a column count or when Spaces, by default, chooses an appropriate column count. Okay? And it's also important to ensure you have enough SSD devices to drive throughput and IOPS to I/O on the SSD tier. And it's important you buy good SSD devices. Buy SAS SSD devices. You need SAS for clustering. Okay? If you have workloads that you expect to have high churn or be write intensive, go buy write intensive SSDs. You know, there's lots of good EMLC SSDs out there that have excellent endurance. All right? So in a 24-bay JBOD, we recommend a minimum of 2 columns. So the scale at this scale level, your performance needs will likely not be nearly as high as with much larger scales. So 2 column count we found to be appropriate for most workloads running at this scale. With a 2-way mirror, to get 2 column count, that means you want a minimum of 4 SSD devices. With 3-way mirror, you'd want 6. 2 times 3, 6. With a 60-bay JBOD, there's a lot more scale here. There's a lot more capacity because you're using 3.5-inch disks as opposed to 2.5-inch disks. And we'd recommend a minimum of 4 columns to drive the best performance out of the hard drives. That means for a 2-way mirror, you'd want 8 SSDs. For a 3-way mirror, you'd want a minimum of 12. And these are just minimums. You can have a lot more. You know, there are workloads that require a lot more. But the point is to make sure you buy enough SSD capacity as your workload's working set size. We've done testing we've looked at heat maps of different workloads internally, and we found that a good working set size tends to be close to 8% of the capacity. So ensure you have enough SSDs to cover that. Otherwise, it really depends on your workloads, but we recommend something around 8%. We've been working with Dell to establish some workload guidance, workload-specific guidance, and we have guidance for 2 workloads at the moment. And the first one is a pooled VDI desktop. So this is where you have a parent VHDX, and as you create more desktops, you spin off diffs for each one. We recommend that you pin the parent VHDX file of the pooled desktop collection to the SSD tier. And when you create your pooled desktop collection in RDS, it'll create a _IMGS folder, and you want to pin the VHD file in that folder to the SSD tier. This is done by default, unless you choose a separate location for it to copy the parent from your VHD library. You further want to use separate user profile disks, and you can put these user profile disks on the same tiered volume as well. And something to consider if you want your workload to be ready right away, after you create your collection, you can run and you warm it up by booting the VMs, or you could even do dummy login sessions. You can run tier optimization manually, and I show you how to do this later in the slide deck. And that'll just immediately start to move the heat to the appropriate tiers so you get the best performance right away. Now, tiering operates automatically. It operates at 1 a.m. by default every day, and this is a scheduled task. You can actually adjust the scheduled task, and in the appendix, I show you exactly how to do that. And it's quite easy. Here are the results we got with tiering. We used a Dell MD1220 24-bay JBOD, and we had 2 SAS paths from each PowerEdge R720 server. We had 4 400-gigabyte SAS SSDs and 20 1-terabyte 7200 RPM SAS hard drives. We started by just using the SSDs, but as it turns out, SSDs really don't have a lot of capacity. So we ran out of capacity at around 150 users. Even though the SSDs could do 100,000 IOPS, we can only do 150 users because we didn't have any more capacity left. I don't have the data on the screen here, but if we were to do tests with just a hard drive, just these 20 hard drives in a mirrored space, at about 20 IOPS per user, we would max out the storage at about 70 users. So SSDs don't have enough capacity, hard drives don't have enough performance. With tiering, we're able to push the number of users up to 700. 150 users SSD ran out of capacity. 70 users of hard drives ran out of performance. Tiering gave us the best IOPS per dollar and dollars per terabyte with this workload. Another workload that we found to be quite excellent with tiering is the personal desktop. And there's some specific guidance here as well. You want to use data deduplication in VDI mode to optimize performance and capacity utilization. Now, we made enhancements to dedupe in R2 so we can live dedupe VMs. We support live deduping of VDI personal desktops with dedupe in this release. After deploying your collection, run dedupe immediately so it can get all that data that you just deployed shrunk down into a much smaller space. And once I have this much smaller space, tiering will come along and optimize that. Once tiering optimizes that deduped area, it will make all your VMs much faster because all the access goes through that deduped area, which is now going to be on the SSD tier, or a good portion of it will be on the SSD tier. You'll get the best performance and capacity savings for deduped personal desktops when you have desktops with low write churn. As you have more writes in the system, or as all the VMs start doing a lot of writes, if you have that kind of workload, then you're not going to get as good of capacity savings. Now, tiering will, of course, optimize those writes if you have a write that's just constantly going. And that's good, because you don't want those writes to cause too many seeks to the hard drives. But you will get the best capacity savings if you have workloads with low write churn. Okay. And with the same hardware, the same Dell MD1220 JBOD, we saw 720 users we can bring up with the login VSI medium workload at a 90% capacity savings over non-deduped. A lot of users, a lot of capacity savings here. I'm going to stress that tiering requires certified components. So all levels, all links in the chain must be certified. You must have certified SSDs, certified enclosures. You must use SAS HBAs without hardware RAID. And you want to ensure that everything else in your deployment is certified and, of course, as I said before, has enough compute and bandwidth to drive the performance you're going to get out of tiering. Last year, I talked about a case study for an internal deployment. We basically run a Windows build, basically relies on Spaces to store an incredible amount of data. And when they first deployed Spaces, they actually overran their network switching. They didn't have enough bandwidth to drive the sheer amount of throughput that Spaces gave them. So it's really important to make sure that every link in your chain has enough compute and bandwidth to support Spaces, because you're going to see an incredible amount of performance. You can check the Windows Server catalog here. Once you download the presentation, you can find the link. There's a good listing of all the certified components we have. And there's a section on storage spaces. Once you've chosen the appropriate set of hardware, you've chosen the SSDs, you've chosen the hard drive, you've chosen their capacities, how many you want, what kind of enclosures, how many enclosures, the servers. Once you've chosen all that, you're obviously going to rack them up. Once you rack them up, it's important to validate that the hardware you have, especially the hard drives, especially the SSDs, give you good performance and that they support storage spaces. So I wrote a little script here that does physical disk validation of the drives that you intend to use for your storage pool. Make sure that you haven't created a cluster, you haven't created a pool, so just leave the disks as they are. Configure MPIO, configure all the things you need to, but don't create a pool, don't create a cluster. What this script basically does, it goes through all the disks, It figures out if they're healthy. It figures out if they are SaaS. It figures out how many enclosures they're reporting, all right? To make sure that you have enough enclosures for your enclosure awareness. It goes and checks a bunch of things, a bunch of requirements that Spaces has. But in addition to that, we found that some drives can actually give quite a large variance in performance. And this is actually why we recommend working with a OEM to ensure that your drives ensure that every link in the chain will work with Spaces. They have the right firmware updates to work with Spaces. And an OEM will help give you that. So this script will go and group together disks of like model numbers. So if I have SSDs of a certain model, it's going to group that together. It's going to test those drives and actually do performance tests against those drives, reads and writes, and ensure that the IOPS that they return are consistent within one another. It actually checks if it's consistent within a standard deviation. And it'll tell you if you have results that are outside that standard deviation. Okay? It also goes to tell you if there are any reported disk errors after running the workload. So you can find out if you have any disks that are dead on arrival. Okay? And SSDs will typically show that right away if they are going to be bad. It'll also check that the reported latencies are relatively consistent, because latencies can actually be an indicator of an underlying disk error. So make sure you run this disk validation script before you start up your deployment. And I'm actually going to be updating the script with a couple of things just to make it easier to use and to fix one small issue I've noticed. So I'll update this within the week, but please download the script, check it out. I'd appreciate any feedback you guys have. Just fire me an email, brian.matthew@microsoft.com, if you have any issues to the script, and I'll take a look at that right away. Once you've validated your physical disk, you check that all the disks are consistent, and they all support Spaces, and everything is good, it's important to make sure that all your file server nodes, before you cluster them, are in a state that supports clustering. And it also checks if those disks support clustering as well. So, you know, it checks the servers have consistent hotfixes, consistent processors. It warns you if there's network configuration issues. It warns you if you have disks that don't support clustering. Okay? So run these two things. Once you have your hardware racked up to validate, hardware is good to go and will work for Spaces and clustering. Once you've validated your hardware, it's then time to configure your cluster and configure your storage. So there's a couple of articles here that walk through step-by-step how to configure clustered storage spaces, an additional article how to configure a tiered space. So be sure to walk through those articles. Once you have your software configuration all up and running, it's then time to validate that the performance that you see is the performance that you would expect, both locally and over the wire from any SMB clients. And I'm going to do a demo on how you can do that. Oh, and the tool you want to use here is SQL.io. And we have a link for SQL.io right here. So be sure to download SQL.io, because I'm going to use SQL.io for this demo. And it's not the SQL.io version that I'm sure some of you have seen. It's the publicly available SQL.io version. So all the commands that you see today are the commands that you can use in your own deployment. I have a two-node cluster set up. Oh, whoops. Sorry. So I got to get this to the right monitor there. Okay. Apologies. I have a two-node cluster set up. These are the two nodes, FS1 and FS2. Okay. And I've created a storage pool, and you can see that here. And I also have created two virtual disks. And in the back end, I actually have a few SSDs in this deployment. But I have two clustered virtual disks. And these are added to my cluster shared volume. So what cluster shared volume means is that on each node, I can navigate to the cluster namespace, which is cluster storage, and I can see these two volumes here. I've additionally created a scale-out file server, and that's this, and two file shares, one for each virtual disk. Okay? So I want to validate the performance that I get from this storage, these storage spaces locally to ensure there's no throughput or IOPS or latency bottlenecks. So how do I do that? Currently, I'm on file server node 2. So I go to, with my failover cluster UI, I go to the disks window here, and I see that volume 1 has an owner node of FS2 and has a disk number of 5. Okay, and this is my volume 1 down here. So I would then load up the performance counters for disk number 5 on FS2. So I open up Perfmon, I go to add counters, and I scroll to physical disk, and then I find 5 in this window, and then I can add all those perf counters. So I've added a subset of the perf counters here, and you can see them in this window. These three counters, average disk seconds queue length, indicates the load to the virtual disk. Okay, the higher the queue depth, the more parallel the workload. These counters, seconds per read, transfer, and write, indicate the latency of requests, average latency of I/O requests to this virtual disk, how long it took on average for each I/O to be satisfied. And then at the bottom, I have the reads, transfers, and writes per second. So these are IOPS. There's additional counters I didn't add here because there wasn't enough space to show them, but there's counters for throughput as well. So bytes per second read, bytes per second, and bytes per second write. So those indicate to you the throughput that your space is seeing. I have SQL I/O, and my parameters indicate that I'm doing a block size of 4K. I have 12 threads, 8 outstanding I/O per thread, so the parallelism factor of each thread is 8. And I do this test for 30 seconds. And this additional parameter here is telling me to use no file system buffering, because none of my workloads are going to use file system buffering. They're going to go directly to my file server and be serviced by my storage, because that's what CA needs. And it's doing random I/O. You create a test file on that volume 1, share 1 test file. So this test file can also be accessed by the remote node. I'm going to go ahead and start this workload. Oops, wrong keyboard. You can see my perf counters indicate how my storage is doing. Because this is a read workload by default, I can see that the latency of reads are 2 milliseconds. I'm doing somewhere between somewhere around 45,000 IOPS to my virtual disk. And my queue length is about 95, or somewhere around there. Okay? So 2 milliseconds, you know, somewhere around, all right, so 43,980 IOPS I saw there. So I want to now go to a remote node that I would access, that would be accessing the storage over SMB. Now, this typically is your compute node where your workloads are running. So I want to make sure that the performance I see remotely is similar to the performance I see locally. If there's differences in latency or throughput, it would indicate an issue with my configuration, or a network issue, for instance. I now run the same command, but instead of targeting C colon cluster storage, volume 1, et cetera, and so forth, I would go whack-whack to my scale-out file server namespace, and then target the same test file with the same workload. The perf counter in this is a little different, though. So if when I go to add perf counters, I can scroll down to SMB client shares, and I can find the share that I'm connected to. In this case, it would be share 1. And I would add the perf counters for those. So I've added similar perf counters as you saw in the previous one. I'm going to go ahead and start the workload. Wrong keyboard again. So here you're seeing similar 2 millisecond latencies. This is over SMB. And you're seeing similar IOPS. And you're seeing rather similar queue depth. But you also want to note that my two cluster network adapters I'm seeing traffic evenly distributed between them. And what I've configured here is SMB multi-channel. If I'm not seeing this even distribution, I know there's an issue with my configuration. I know there's an issue with somehow I've configured SMB multi-channel or my cluster network's not configured properly. So I want to go check on that. So let's stop this. And I would see I have IOPS of 42,756, which is roughly similar to the 43,980. So there's a little tiny bit of loss over SMB, but my latency was similar, so I know that my configuration should be good to go for my workloads. And you'd also similarly want to test for larger block size I/O to make sure there's no throughput bottlenecks. But in this case, we've just wanted to test for latency in the interest of time. Okay, so let's switch back over to my presentation. Oops. So we've just validated that your cluster, storage, and file shares are all correctly configured. We know that we've tested for latency, and you should have tested for throughput. We don't see any issues. So we've done the best we can. It's now time to run your workload. You've checked all layers of the stack. You make sure your disks are good. You make sure your server's configured right. Make sure your configure's okay. Run your workload now. Now is the time to start up that whatever test workload you have or your actual production workload. And how do I ensure, and how do I monitor that workload now it's running and troubleshoot any issues I see? So there's a couple things that go into this. And first is to monitor health. If I have any reduced resiliency or failed disks, then my performance will likely be slightly degraded. If I have any rebuilds that are in progress, my performance is going to be slightly degraded. So I want to check for that. I also want to monitor latencies on an ongoing manner to ensure that if I have any spikes in latency, I know exactly what causes them. So I can go investigate further. And then I want to actually monitor tiering to see how well tiering is doing at capturing your workload or how your workload is churning if I need to go do additional things to make sure I get optimal performance, such as add more SSDs or run tiering more frequently. First thing to do is monitor health. Okay, we have extensive methods to monitor health. We have PowerShell. We have Server Manager. We have SCVMM. You monitor your health and the progress. We have OM to monitor health and progress of any rebuilds on your virtual disks. And we actually have additional monitoring for storage enclosure health available with this update. So be sure to download this, and you can actually peek into your enclosure and see if you have any failed internal components, and also be able to map a physical enclosure with the physical disks inside to know what enclosure you're using. We have an out-of-box tool called the Server Performance Analyzer. And this is used to monitor, or one part of it is used to monitor storage performance. It uses performance counters that we talked about previously, and I showed you in the demo. But it actually has the ability to configure alerts based on certain thresholds. So for instance, you can configure a threshold that alerts you when you have latency that exceeds, for instance, 30 milliseconds. So if you see that you have a spike in latency, you can go start to investigate what happened. If it was happened at 9 a.m., oh, maybe you can figure out that, oh, all my users logged in. But guess what? Maybe more users logged in than previously anticipated. So I have higher latency. So definitely take a look at the Server Performance Analyzer. It also has some pretty cool trend analysis or week by week basis or day by day as well. That's a very cool tool. But once you've figured out that there is a problem, you need to break down the problem and analyze it layer by layer. So here I have some of the layers that you should look at. I have disaggregated storage and compute. So there's a couple layers on the compute side. We talked about the SMB client checking those perf counters, but there's also something above that as well, because my workload originates from virtual machines. So I want to make sure that there's no, you know, for instance, overscribed CPU or memory of my virtual machines. on the storage layer, I want to ensure that the latencies and throughput between my SMB client and SMB servers are consistent to rule out any networking issues, to rule out also, and of course, the physical disk counters to rule out any physical disk issues. So let's walk through these in a demo. I have a workload running on 4 10K RPM drives. I've chosen an appropriate queue depth here to ensure that my drives shouldn't have a latency more than 25 milliseconds. I have 5 threads and 4 queued up for thread. So that means my disks are going to see individually a queue of about 5. And I know that about 5 queues will give me 25 milliseconds or so. So first thing I want to do is monitor how my workload's doing. And I want to go find the disk number for my virtual disk to be able to pull up the perf counters for that disk. With this command here, I can see that the disk number for this storage space for friendly name trouble virtual disk is 15. So when I go into performance monitor, I pull up the physical disk perf counters for 15. Let's go do that. Here's 15. You can see I have similar counters as before. You'll immediately notice that the average disk seconds per transfer is 30. Well, I thought it was going to be 25. It's a little higher. I look then into perf counters for read and perf counters for write, and I see that my write latencies are very high, way past what I would expect. So clearly, I need to investigate further. Clearly, something out of the ordinary is happening here. First thing I do is check the health of the virtual disk. The operational status is okay. The health status is healthy. So that's not the issue. I can check the health in the underlying physical disk just to be sure. And also, at the same time, get the disk numbers for those disks. And this would be gotten through the device ID on the physical disk object. That would correlate to physical disk number in perf counter. I can see 5, 13, 9, and 6 on the underlying disks, and they're all healthy. So let's pull up the perf counters for those disks. Again, similar perf counters. I look at the latency for each one. I see 13 is good, 15 is good, 6 is good. But 9 has very high latencies, way past what I would expect for a 10K RPM disk. So something is wrong with 9. Something is strange that's going on here. We have an object in the system called a storage reliability counter. And this counter is able to give me unique smart statistics on the drive in addition to statistics that Windows tracks. So we have statistics like read latency max, write latency max, flush latency, and we also record temperature of any disks that support it, and also report errors that we see. So I'm going to pull a subset of the fields we have on the storage reliability counters for 13, 5, 6, and 9. These disks have gotten quite a bit of load over the past little while, so these two fields are rather high. But you can look at all these fields to figure out if there is a drive that has much higher read latency max than the other, or write latency max than the other ones. I also notice that none of the drives have reported any read or write errors. So I know that there's nothing wrong, physically wrong, with the drives themselves. So what else am I supposed to do? Maybe the firmwares are mismatched between the drives. Maybe I have a drive with bad firmware, or I chose the wrong drives in the first place. So I take a look at the drives again. You'll notice that, again, 9 was my bad drive. So then I compare firmware version. I see that disk 9 has actually a different firmware version. And if you look really closely, it actually is of a different model number. So guess what? I was stupid. And instead of using a 10K RPM drive here, I actually used a 7200 RPM drive. So this is why my performance was so poor, because I used a different RPM speed drive than the rest, a slower RPM speed drive than the rest of the drives in my pool, which brought down the performance. So you can also picture this as being the scenario if I have a drive that's probably about to fail. That drive could exhibit higher latencies than the rest of the drive and queue up more I/O than the rest of the drive, deliver less bandwidth, deliver less throughput, and also exhibit read or write errors. So even though I constructed this test here artificially by using different RPM speed drive, the same logic applies for any deployment you have. Okay. Now on to troubleshooting tiered volumes. So while this data movement happens automatically and in a scheduled manner, there are a couple situations where performance may not be as optimal as you would like. So some workloads actually exhibit or can exhibit very high churn. So that means they activate new data rather than activate previous data. Because tiering works on the premise that the heat today will be similar to the heat at the next run. That's how you get the best performance out of tiering. And that's why we got the best performance out of that VDI workload, because the workload tends to not churn a lot. But there are workloads, again, that do churn, and it's important to take note of that when deploying a tiered space and when troubleshooting tiering. There can also be specific hardware issues that are specific to devices of a certain tier. So for instance, if I have an SSD device that is so degraded, or maybe I use an older SSD device that has become degraded, that can actually reduce the performance, just like you saw in that previous demo. So maybe my SSDs can do 60,000 IOPS, but I have an SSD that can only do 20 because it's gotten a lot more wear than the others. And most basically, there might just be not enough SSD capacity in that virtual disk to contain the majority of your working set. Now, we have a few tools that help you troubleshoot tiering and figure out what to do, which situation you might be in. We first of all have, you can monitor the health of your physical disks. You can monitor the health of your virtual disk. If you have a disk that's unhealthy or it rebuilds in progress, then that could be an indicator that your performance will be degraded like you saw previously. We also have a report that's generated after the manual invoke of tier optimization. And there's a couple ways, to invoke tier optimization here, and here's a reference for you. There's also the individual performance counters on SSDs and hard drives. So like you saw in my demo, you get virtual disk, you pipe that to physical disk, and you get the underlying disks of that virtual disk. And then you can sort that by media type to figure out what's SSDs and what's HDDs to debug the disks that are the issue. And we also have our pinning mechanism, which you can use to pin files to certain tiers and then do synthetic workload to those files or just run your workload on that tier and see if they still are a problem or not. So this is a snapshot of what the tiering report looks like. This is just a snippet of that report. Okay? So there's a lot of data in this report. I want to walk you through step by step how to interpret this report and how to take action from it. The first thing to note is this 100% here. Okay? This 100% indicates the total I/O, which is tracked by the tiering engine. And this indicates the majority of the I/O on your virtual disk. This star here indicates the current size of the SSD tier, which is 1.46 terabytes in this case, and correlates to whatever is indicated with a star in this table. And we round to the closest 5%, so in this case it was 95. We can see that this indicates the ideal I/O distribution for the current SSD tier size for the current workload conditions. So what this means is that assuming the workload does not change and given enough runs for tiering, we can service 95% of the workloads out of the SSD tier. Tiering does not move, does not churn the entire SSD tier every time you run optimization. Doing so would introduce a lot of wear on the SSDs and might actually reduce performance. So at each tier optimization run, we move out at most 50% of the SSD tier and move the same amount of data in. And this bottom number indicates the current I/O distribution post-optimization. you'll notice that my current number is 87%, and my ideal number is actually greater than 95%. So when these two numbers are different, it can actually indicate that there's a lot of workload churn that's going on, which means that the working set of my workload is shifting faster than tiering can catch up with it. Okay? There's a couple things you can do with this report. First of all, if you see that this ideal IO distribution is too low, if it was much lower than it currently was, it could indicate that you don't have large enough SSD tier to handle your working set size. So what you can do is you can expand the SSD tier with some of the capacity that I recommend you reserve earlier, or you can rebalance a subset of your workloads to a virtual disk with a greater ideal IO distribution, so more room to handle large working sets. Another thing you can do is you can add more SSDs to your deployment in the units of columns times copies. And actually, as you add more SSDs to a virtual disk, spaces will, when tier optimization one runs, will reflow any hot data onto those drives automatically. We'll use that capacity right away when the tier optimization is run. So that is a way that you can expand your virtual disk and get more performance. Another thing you can use with this report is, as I said before, if you have high workload churn. So what you can do is you can run tiering immediately again, manually, and see if this number, this current IO distribution, actually improves. And you can run it successively to see if it improves anymore. But most basically, and what I would recommend, is that you can increase the frequency of the optimization schedule. And we have this in the appendix on how exactly, step-by-step, how to do this. Or any workloads that you expect to churn a lot, you can pin those workloads to the SSD tier to guarantee the performance from the SSD tier. So I'd like to wrap up. I only have a few minutes left. Spaces, as you saw in the performance results we got from those workloads, provided us very high performance storage with exceptional IOPS per dollar and dollars per terabyte. We can only get a little VMs on the SSD because we didn't have enough capacity. With the hard drives, we didn't have enough performance. Tiering gave us a heck of a lot more than those could do alone. You want to carefully plan your storage deployments for capacity, performance, and resiliency to disk failure and resiliency to enclosure failure. You want to figure out what you can handle. Always use Windows-certified hardware. Check the catalog. Work with an OEM. Make sure you have all the links in your chain certified. Once you have the hardware, systematically validate it for any issues with the hardware itself or with software configurations. And, of course, run those synthetic workload tests locally and remote to see if you have any bottlenecks or kinks in your chain. And monitor the performance and health over time with SPA, and use the tools that I've given you to figure out any additional tuning or tweaking necessary if you need it. So there's a few more sessions I'd recommend you attend. If you have more questions, definitely come up to the front after the end of presentation. My colleague Chris Robinson and Philip Moss will definitely help answer your questions. But you can find us at the storage booth. Well, I guess the Ask the Experts events already happened, so yeah. There are some additional resources. And I'd definitely appreciate any feedback you have. I only had an hour session, so I couldn't fit everything I wanted to fit in. But definitely come to the front if you have any questions, and I'll try to answer them as best as I can. Thank you so much. Some of the issues we find at each layer of the stack. This one walks through how to save off the tiering report automatically, how to change the optimization schedule. And this one talks about a little bit additional perf planning you want to take a look at, especially when planning servers and stuff like that. So download the deck, and I also embedded the demos in the deck as well, so you can take a look at that at your leisure. All right? Thank you. Let me turn off the mic here.